Welcome back to the show. Thank you very much for joining me this evening. Special birthday greetings go out to Grant Wilson from the television series Ghost Hunters on the Sci-Fi Channel. 42 years old today. Happy birthday, Grant. Our guest this evening for the remainder of the show, Matt Wingett, is the author of Conan Doyle and the Mysterious World of Light, 1887 to 1920. We're talking about Conan Doyle and his interest in the occult and the supernatural, his writings for Light magazine. I'm curious, with his work with the Cyclical Society of Paranormal Research, was he often coming up against people that were trying to defraud or fake things and try to embarrass Conan Doyle or the investigators?
There's two sides to it. There were very, very strong members of the SPR, the Society for Psychical Research, who were very strong investigators who wanted to debunk frauds. And then on the other side, you've also got people who tried to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. There was a very famous case of the masked medium in about 1916. The Daily Express had put down a challenge that if anyone could show beyond doubt that they had manifested the spirit of a deceased person, that they would be paid the fortune of £500 sterling. What happened with that one was that Conan Doyle attended, and the masked medium did indeed manifest strange phenomena. Somebody seemed to see something or somebody moving, but it was all unclear and it was not entirely proven. Later on, it turned out that her agent was a guy called Mr. Selbit, and Mr. Selbit was a stage conjurer and had taught her all of these wonderful techniques to bamboozle people. He was very cautious about that one, but I do find it interesting his relationship with Houdini went the other way, which is that Houdini said to him, you're saying that all of these people are able to do this stuff. Let me show you how they do it. And he demonstrated the different conjuring tricks that you could use in order to fake a manifestation. And Conan Doyle said, well, that's all very well and good. You've shown that you can recreate what really happens. He said, just because you can show me that you can do it one way doesn't mean it can't happen the other way. So he really clung on to that, and it drove Houdini to exasperation. And there were other times when Conan Doyle became absolutely convinced that Houdini actually genuinely had psychic powers and that he was pretending that he didn't have, because it would have ruined his reputation as a conjurer. So it's a very interesting milieu that you're moving in there, a very interesting set of people indeed.
Right, and what a strange friendship those two had. They ended up on the outs because of the abilities or claimed abilities of Conan Doyle's wife, isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the real nails in the coffin for them. What happened was that Gene Leckie, or Gene Conan Doyle, as he'd become, offered to put Houdini in touch with his deceased mother. And so he attended this seance, and she started doing automatic writing and writing messages from from Houdini's mother across to Houdini, saying, oh, my dear son, it's so lovely to see you again, blah, 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 this kind of thing. And Houdini kind of sat there and listened to and watched what was going on, and then kind of was very polite about it, but afterwards commented, it's very strange that my mother, who couldn't even string two words of English together when she was speaking, is suddenly able to write fluently in English. And that really was one of the big starts of big rifts between them, because there was no going back from that, really. I mean, essentially what he was saying was that Lady Conan Doyle was either deluded or a fraud. And there's not much you can do with that as a friend, is there?
No, isn't it interesting, though? You'd think that, what we've heard now from the spiritualist movement and psychics and mediums is that when they're getting their messages, of course, they're going to get messages in the way that it would make sense to them, almost like a universal translator. So,
sure.
if she couldn't speak a lick of English, but all that Lady Doyle could understand was English, she would be discerning it in that English language. I also thought it was funny because she ended the message with the crucifix, which irritated him because he was Jewish. in faith and claimed his mother would never have done that. And I've often sat back and wondered, maybe she was trying to get a message through to Harry that their belief system might not have been on the button, and there was a difference in this.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of ways of looking at it. I know that Oliver Lodge, who was a good friend, a scientist, and a very good friend of Conan Doyle, also, you know, he received messages from him, his son, Raymond Lodge. And Raymond, you know, informed him that there were schools and on the other side that taught people all sorts of things and taught them other languages and things like this. And that when you get over to the other side, suddenly you're not held back by your body and your brain. And so you can learn all of this stuff really quickly and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, there's lots and lots of ways around how, you know, that criticism of from Houdini to Doyle, if you're so minded to do so. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, we need to take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue with Matt Wingett right after this. We'll be opening up phone lines in a little bit if you have questions for our guest regarding Arthur Conan Doyle, Houdini, or the spirit world and the work he did. Let's continue on, Matt. This man was so fascinating in everything that he was involved in and the life that he led. I mean, he was so rich and diverse, right? And the fact that he was open to these ideas and possibilities that something greater than our physical life might exist beyond.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he's an extraordinary man. And it's not all he did. I mean, you know, this is the spiritualism, I mean, really took over his life. There was an event occurred in Southsea in about 1919, where after his son had died, he attended a seance in Southsea in Portsmouth. And that's where he re-encountered his son. He met him after death in a seance. He'd been giving a talk about life after death during the day. And then in the evening, he'd retired to his hotel with a medium, and the medium had put him in touch with his son, and he wrote about it very movingly, saying, "Oh, you know, my son stood over me, and I felt a kiss on my forehead, and a hand pat my head, and they had a conversation, and then his son disappeared, you know, demanifested. Of course, it was all in darkness because that's the way that it was done back then." And so, you know, there was no visual sighting of his son, but he was absolutely and utterly convinced. And that really was, for him, the thing that really strengthened his view, so that after that he became an international missionary for the last 10 years of his life, traveling all over the world, spreading the word of spiritualism. It's, yeah, an extraordinary, and that's just one aspect of him. There were so many others. He was a pioneer of skiing. He was also a pioneer cyclist. He was he helped to get the Court of Appeal set up in the UK because he investigated crimes which had been wrongly found guilty. And so his proving that crimes had been wrongly adjudicated meant that the Court of Appeal, which did not exist before in the UK, was set up so that convictions could be looked at again. Unsafe convictions. I mean, it extraordinary. It just goes on and on and on. He traveled to the front during World War One. He was involved in the Boer War. Yeah, the man's energy was just extraordinary.
What was his ties to Aleister Crowley?
You know, I don't know. What I do know is that he did have a brief meeting or a brief brush with the Golden Dawn, of which Aleister Crowley was certainly a member. He talked about it in Pearson's magazine in 1924 when he was approached in 1906 by a guy called Dr. Pullen Berry. And Pullen Berry basically said, "I'm a member of a secret organization and we think you'd be a great member of it." And he said, "Well, what does it do?" He said, "Well, we're talking about psychic links, we're talking about astral projection, we're talking about all sorts of stuff." And Conan Doyle was fascinated. And he said, "Well, what do I need to do?" He said, "You need to do nothing. We will adjudicate. We will look at you and see whether or not you're right for us." And he heard nothing from them. And then one morning, he said he woke up with this incredible tingling sensation all over his body, like he'd had an electric shock. And Pullenberry comes back. He says, "Yes, we've decided that you can be a member." And at this point, I think Conan Doyle lost his nerve a little bit and went, maybe not, and decided not to join. And Pullenberry tried a couple of times to get him to join the Golden Dawn, of which, of course, Aleister Crowley was a member, but he didn't join. he didn't join. So if there were further connections with Crowley, I'd love to know about them.
For listeners that aren't familiar, can you explain the Golden Dawn?
Oh, the Golden Dawn. The Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was a Kabbalistic secret society which was involved in what was essentially a kind of Gnostic view of the world, which basically believed in spirit communication, psychic abilities, all sorts of stuff. Essentially, it was a kind of a cult secret society. Essentially, is what it was.
What did you find?
I mean, there were members. I mean, Aleister Crowley wasn't, you know, I mean, there were really major members of it. I think Oscar Wilde was a member. Somebody told me recently W.B. Yeats was a member. I mean, you know, these were really important cultural figures of the time.
What were some of the more fascinating aspects of Doyle's life you uncovered while you were doing the research for this book?
There are just so many. I think the thing that really highlights, really comes through from the study of Conan Doyle is his extraordinary energy. I think, you know, this is why he got into so many different things. Like I say, I mean, going over to the Boer War, getting involved with that, getting involved in going to the front of World War I. He even invented or tried to invent a new type of weapon that would be useful, on the front, which unfortunately didn't go anywhere. I think the military didn't see any use for it. But, I mean, you know, it's so difficult to say what particularly, because there's so much. But I think the thing that stands out is just how energetic it was at everything that he did. He would throw his heart and soul into it. He started a series of talking tours about spiritualism in 1916, and he worked out that in the year 1917, he'd addressed over 100,000 people traveling around the UK, addressing village halls and town halls and assembly rooms all around the country. It's an extraordinary figure, extraordinary, you know, before the age of mass communication.
Right. What an ability this guy had to get around. You know, I'm sure many doors were opened up as being one of the most famous authors in the world and creating one of the most famous characters anywhere. People loved, as you said earlier, Sherlock Holmes. So that, even though he dreaded what he did, I'm sure that he must have enjoyed the luxuries that that opened up for him and the doors that he was able to get through.
I think that's right. I mean, I look at it, his sojourn in Portsmouth in 1887, and the two things happened in the same year. He wrote his first book on Sherlock Holmes, which was A Study in Scarlet, in 1887. That was published in the Christmas edition of the Beaton's Christmas Annual in 1887. And the same year, he got into spiritualism. And I kind of look at it like this. I kind of think, well, you know, the thing is that what the Sherlock Holmes side did was it gave him the money and the fame to do whatever he wanted. And so that had therefore enabled him to follow the spiritualist line even more. It's fascinating that the kind of esoteric and mystical should be so dependent on the money of the materialist Sherlock Holmes. It's a kind of fascinating, you know, relationship there.
Was he ever frightened by the aspect of the investigations he was involving himself in?
He never ever comes across as being frightened. He never ever talks about that. He does talk about sort of having a sense of the sublime, you know, that kind of romantic feeling of kind of being deeply inspired and moved. But he never really talks about it as terror or fear. He talks about it as kind of, an otherworldly feeling. I've not yet encountered anything. I mean, he may do because his writing was so extensive, but I've not yet encountered anything that kind of equates it with terror. I think he found comfort in it, really.
Well, I didn't know if, you know, being spiritualist and being open to that idea, realizing that, you know, there is evil out there and there is some dark stuff. And when you're going up against, you know, claims of poltergeist
you see, you're coming at this from a Christian perspective.
Sure.
He didn't actually equate ghosts and poltergeists with evil. He regarded, because what he didn't see is an afterlife which was divided between God and the devil. What he thought that was absolute medieval nonsense. He thought, you know, the idea of a devil, somehow torturing people for eternity. He didn't believe that a God would create a universe in which such a nonsensical and brutal thing would happen. What he believed is that after death, if you had sinned, if you had done bad, you would go on to a lower plane on the other side than those who had lived good lives. And you would be given a further chance and further chance and further chance to evolve and grow. Essentially, it was spiritual evolution is what he believed in. He didn't believe in eternal punishment and damnation. He thought that was just a brutal, nonsensical, old-fashioned, outdated idea.
No, very progressive and forward thinking at that time. And I guess, you know, especially now hearing that there are that is such a big belief system that we have this soul incarnation levels that we're allowed to kind of try to rebuild or fix what we've done, our karmic justice here on planet Earth.
Sure.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, if you remember, I said to you that he'd been exposed to A.P. Sinnott very early on, Sinnott being a right-hand man of Madame Blavatsky. He, on the back of that, he wrote a story called The Mystery of Klumba in the 1880s. And The Mystery of Klumba is exactly about Buddhists. He hadn't quite got his head around what Buddhists were yet. These Buddhists arrived in Britain to take revenge upon an army general in Scotland, which is not at all what a Buddhist would do. But you can see that there's that fascination with the esoteric and with the Eastern. And that whole Eastern idea does not rely on punishment in the same way that the kind of Judeo-Christian tradition does in the West.
Very cool. His wife, when she was developing this ability, was he helping to propagate that, or, you know, push it out there and help her? Or was that something that was more like, you know, parlor talk and making that available when people were over, as opposed to, you know, publicizing it grand, you know, on a more grand scale?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. The way that it appears in the newspaper reports and the magazines, and I've immersed myself in this for, you know, for a good couple of years to try and understand it, is that she very much is second fiddle. When Conan Doyle goes out and gives his talks, she's very often there, you know, sort of a supportive influence. But she isn't reported as being kind of, you know, a kind of major player in her own right. Although I'm sure that she was giving private readings and private sittings with people, absolutely. In fact, you know what you've just done is you've lit a light bulb up in my head, which says, actually, the story of Lady Jean Benadryl would be an interesting story to track on in its own right. So thank you very much for that.
Well, no problem. Just make sure you include me in the afterwards or forewords and the thank yous in the book. That's all I ask for. I'm not a big guy on that.
Sure.
We're going to open up phone lines for people that have questions regarding his work and the articles that he wrote in these magazines. He really put himself out there without kind of fear of being criticized too much, too, didn't he? He was more open and just, hey, this is the truth as I see it. This is what I want to investigate. And it seems almost like it was reckless abandon to, you know, hey, you know, let other people's position on me be damned. This is what I need to look into.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the thing that he did was he just said, I've done all the investigation. I've done 30 years of investigation. I know this is true. So, you know, we can carry on having the same old arguments over and over and over again, but I'm not interested in that. All I'm here to do is to tell you it's true. So he's gone way beyond self-doubt and wanting to get into arguments over the kind of the basics. He just did not respond to that at all. So yeah, absolutely. He just got out there and said what he believed to be true. Absolutely.
When we come back, I'd like to know, were there any points of the supernatural or paranormal that he did poo-poo, that he didn't have any kind of faith or belief in? We'll talk about that and so much more. Plus, we'll take your phone calls. Phone lines are open. We'll be putting out those phone numbers for you momentarily. And remember, if you enjoy the Talk of the Strange and the Supernatural, you can join me 5 nights a week, Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight on my own show, Darkness Radio. You can find more information at darknessradio.com. Stream our show live from our website. And remember to stay tuned, because as soon as our show wraps up, it begins streaming Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. We'll be back with more of the best in overnight talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Make sure you swing by and check out our website at coasttocoastam.com. Check out all the great news that we have on the site. Remember, it is UFO Day 2016, so you can go check that out. We also have an article about an inventor that has built a homemade laser bazooka. And if that's not weird enough for you, there's weird recordings of Juno probe entering Jupiter's magnetic field and top 10 strangest UFO sightings in Canada. and a fatal Tesla car crash that could set back autonomous navigation. So go check out the website for all of that information. And while you're there, sign up to become a Coast Insider. A one-year subscription right now, only 15 cents a day. You can't get better pricing for that. All of the amount of entertainment you get from Coast to Coast AM, all of the shows, the last 5 years of shows of archives, and that means you can listen to the last 3.5 years I've been hosting and filling in. So check out all of those great episodes and live chats with George Norrie, the other hosts, and many of the top-notch guests that we have here on Coast to Coast AM. All that information is on the site. And remember, if you like what you hear on Coast to Coast AM, go check out beyondbelief.com, George Norrie's TV series. You can find out more about that at beyondbelief.com. When we come back, we'll take your phone calls. We'll continue talking with Matt Wingett. And what was the line in the sand that Arthur Conan Doyle drew? Did he believe in all aspects of the strange and supernatural, or were there things even too strange for Doyle to believe in? We'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. Conan Doyle and the Mysterious World of Light, 1887 to 1920. Matt Wingett, our guest this evening. Matt, was there a line he drew in the sand? Was there ever any aspect that he just said, this is too outlandish to believe?
You know, I've been reading lots and lots of his stuff, and I may not have encountered, may have missed something, because, you know, his writing is so extensive. But thus far, I've never found an aspect of the paranormal that he's not willing to at least consider and look into. If you know better than me, then please tell me, because that's an aspect of his investigations that I just haven't encountered. What I do find is that he will, for example, look at a spirit photograph and go, "Oh no, this one's definitely a fake." It's not that he believed in all spirit photography. You know, he would be able to identify ones that he thought was a fake, and he would then make a distinction between that one and ones that he thought were real. So it's, yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, yeah. What have you heard, Dave?
I haven't done that. That's why I was just curious if there was an aspect that he, you know, thought outlandish, the Loch Ness Monster, or, you know, Bigfoot-type creatures, or, you know, anything that obviously he believed in the fairy aspect. But, you know, where did he stand on things like the Strigoi, the vampires, and that whole aspect?
Yeah, I mean, I've not yet encountered anything about vampires, but he did write a book called A Parasite. And in A Parasite, he's not a vampire, but it is somebody who sort of, through hypnosis, takes control of somebody else's mind and is able to remotely control them, and has a kind of parasitic relationship with them. And that's a novel. But I think that this is the kind of key to him, really, which is that he had such an active and wild imagination. He was willing to countenance anything, or at least look into it. We were in a scientific time when science didn't have the same constraints that it had now, and he was essentially a romantic figure who was willing to consider anything. So yeah, I mean, I would love to hear from people if they know of something that he definitely went, no, that whole area is out. I'd love to know about that. Yeah,
I know he was friends with Bram Stoker as well, correct?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So, I mean, this guy...
As part of the literary scene, you've got to bear in mind that Conan Doyle was the second most famous writer in the English language at the time. The most famous was Rudyard Kipling. And isn't it interesting how Rudyard Kipling's fame and fortune has declined, really? I mean, he's only really now known for The Jungle Book.
Right.
And Conan Doyle's life just goes up and up and up. His stocks are always rising, it seems.
Right. And it's interesting, too, because you think about these authors and then you think about when they were so famous. And then when you realize who was connected to who, I mean, the guy, like you said, he was friends with Rudyard Kipling, J.M. Barrie, who created Peter Pan, Bram
Right.
Stoker, Robert Louis Stevenson. All of these amazing people lived at the same time and interacted in the same literary circles. Just an amazing time.
When he visited America, he actually dropped in on Rudyard Kipling, and they had an impromptu game of golf in a field in the back. And the locals hadn't seen golf before, and they were just absolutely sort of mystified what these two English blokes were doing, or British blokes were doing in a field out the back of their house. You know, so yeah, I mean, there was all of this stuff going on.
Let's go to Wildcard Line 1, John from Long Beach, California. John, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Hey, thanks. I'm real quick. I'm a big fan of Arthur Conan Doyle too. What amazes me is how much work the guy must have had great attention to detail and didn't waste much time, because he did. You know, he was in his spare time almost. He was writing the you know, the Sherlock Holmes books and stuff. He's a pretty amazing character. But I want to ask you, did he have any offer any insight into who he thought might be the Jack the Ripper, the Jack the Ripper killings, Whitechapel, and all that? If he you know, dabbled in that.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one, isn't it? The only thing that I came across as a reference to Jack the Ripper in Conan Doyle's work was that there was a famous doctor who was a forensic scientist who looked into the Jack the Ripper case in the 1880s, 1890s. Yeah. And later on, I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head. It's in the book, but I just can't remember his name. But later on, just before he died, he had previously heavily criticized spiritualism, but before he died, he actually said, no, I take that all back. It's what he'd been saying was that there was a lot of lunacy associated with spiritualism, and that it was a higher rate of lunacy among spiritualists than the average population. And later on, he took that back. But that's the only connection that I came across with Jack the Ripper. I mean, that's a fascinating, you know, connection to make, and it would make a great set of novels if someone hasn't done it yet.
Great. Thank you very much for calling in. Let's go to first-time caller line. Elena, is that right, from Roanoke, Virginia?
That's correct. Thank you.
Certainly, Elena.
Oh, I love Coast to Coast. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Our pleasure. Thank you for tuning in tonight. What did you want to talk with our guest about?
Well, I'm a big fan of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Love Sherlock Holmes. Absolutely love the new BBC version, where he is a highly functioning sociopath.
Right.
Wonderful. Very neat twist on that. My point is how this man has researched Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. How much does he think Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's drug use influenced both his paranormal beliefs as well as his writings of Sherlock Holmes?
That's an interesting question. It's something that I have not encountered at all in the research I've done. He was a doctor. He would have had access to all sorts of medical drugs and so on, but I've not yet encountered anything about him being a serious user or a user of drugs in any of the writings that I've gone over to find this. So at the moment, and I'm easily persuadable if someone finds me some evidence, at the moment I would say none is my answer. But I could be wrong. I'm perfectly happy to be proven wrong. So please do if somebody knows better.
All right. Let's go to wildcard line 2. Jay in Florida, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to say, Dave, you always get the best weekend shows, and you always play the best bumper music and do a superb job at matching it to the themes of the show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I just had a birthday, June 30th.
Well, happy birthday.
Okay, I was wondering if he understood how they had equated that Lucifer was the bringer of light, since light was a theme, and that Aleister Crowley was basically considered, you know, a father or founder of Satanism, and forgive me, I wasn't sure if he had a connection to Madame Blavatsky or that was Houdini or both, and if he understood about really his beliefs and opinions of Wicca, Satanism, and if he believed in demons, evil spirits, malevolent entities, or anything like that that existed on other planes or dimensions or ever encountered them any, since he said he didn't have the typical belief of God, the devil, heaven, and hell.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because hello, by the way. It's interesting because the question is framed very strongly within a series of assumptions that that the Christian analysis of the universe is correct. You know, because Satanism is essentially a Christian heresy. And it's true that Aleister Crowley was called the Great Satan, but Satanism existed before Aleister Crowley for sure. So it's a kind of interesting it's an interesting question, because I don't really think that Conan Doyle was particularly interested in the idea, beyond fiction, that is, of kind of malevolent spirits. I think that he felt that he had a much more progressive view, which was that if something is doing bad, it's because it hasn't yet reached some stage of enlightenment or understanding. So you don't get an entity which is, as far as I understand from his writing, you don't get an entity which is deliberately out to do evil. You know, so yeah, I mean, I think that his whole worldview is very different from the starting place of the question, if you see what I mean.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies to Valerie. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
Yes. Thank you for this excellent guest and
thank you
for promoting this Conan Doyle, Arthur Conan Doyle's work and, you know, knowledge about it and consciousness, because there's a lot of silly, you know, archaic beliefs in being promoted all around the U.S. about, you know, the weird Bible prophecies and stuff that detract from a higher level of a higher spiritual intelligent level of consciousness, which your thing is really promoting. And I also think also it would also help if you did look into his wife and do a separate section on her. And I don't think even though a lot of us appreciate that, a lot of us would not have time to do that research. So you certainly deserve credit for doing that. It would really help.
Well, thank you, Valerie. Yeah, he's doing a great job on pulling this stuff together, yeah.
If you want me to go on, buy the book, because I need some money to carry on. So, yeah, absolutely. But I would love to do the the Lady Jean Conan Doyle story. It's quite an interesting story, and it's thanks to Dave's discussion earlier on that's really come to me. So, yeah, a very, very interesting aspect of Conan Doyle's life. Quite right, yeah.
Do you know, did Houdini and Doyle ever end up mending fences before both of their deaths?
I don't think they did. I know that I'm not sure, but because as I said earlier, I haven't fully researched the Houdini aspect of Conan Doyle's life. But as far as I understand it, many spiritualists regarded it as a kind of, you know, which is a silly, silly thing to think, as a kind of retribution for his going against spiritualism and asking all these questions. I think that was kind of the lunatic fringe end of the spiritualist movement that thought those things. But I don't think they ever did, and I think that was a regret for Doyle later on, quite possibly. Yeah.
All right, let's go to wild card line one. Pete from Chicago, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing? So, you know, I've researched a lot about Houdini.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's a really fascinating guy. There's got to be a paranormal aspect to him. You know, maybe he's not a vampire, but I know he had to have dealt in like some kind of blood magic or something occult for him to do the things he did. And you know what? To be honest, I'm not even convinced he's dead. I really think he might still be out there. You know, there's got to be more to it. Just the crazy, crazy things Harry Houdini did. You know, like,
well, what specifically, Pete? I mean, there's been illusionists since Houdini's time, and better illusionists that have been able to pull off the tricks, and they've actually gone on and there's been TV series where they've unmasked how a lot of those tricks were done. And yes, he was a physical masterpiece as well, but he would talk about his escapes. He would hide in the calluses of his feet. He would hire thin wires that he could use to pick locks. He was able to dislocate his shoulder in order to slip from a lot of the different shackles and straitjackets he was put into. So he had quite a great physical prowess and an ability at sleight of hand and illusions. But what did you think specifically about him made him appear to have some kind of supernatural ability?
You know, how could you put somebody in a box like that and they shut the box, put him in water, and he just gets out? He's just fine. You know, like, I'm telling you, I really think there's more to Harry Houdini than we really know. Who knows, man? He could be still around today. I mean, I'm telling you, there's all sorts of witchcraft and occult and crazy stuff going on these days. Harry Houdini very well could have been involved in that.
Can I say you're not the only person to have thought that during the research that I was doing for this, and I think it's in the book, there was a letter written in to Light magazine saying exactly this, that although everyone, you know, who was the kind of authority on the matter, who were considered authorities on the matter, were convinced that he was you know, a physical conjurer, that there was a very, very strong strand at the time of people who were convinced that he had paranormal activity, paranormal abilities. So yeah, I mean, it's a strand that has a discourse that has been there right from the beginning. So I'm not surprised to hear it now.
Well, it's fascinating how people, and thank you so much for calling in, Pete, how people love their icons, right? I mean, there's been speculation from everything that Lincoln's death was faked or that he was shot, but that they ended up saving him and he worked behind the scenes. JFK was believed to have survived his wounds. You know, Elvis Presley supposedly slipped the bonds of death and actually faked his death in order to go into the Witness Protection Agency, which is interesting because there is a document that was signed, I think, 2 weeks after his death in a mob sting that had been done. And his signature is part of that document, but it was signed 2 weeks after he reportedly passed away. But we have such a fascination with our heroes and celebrities to not want to let them go. So to believe that Houdini didn't really die and that he may still be alive, he'd be like 128 or something at this point.
Right. Well, I mean, you've actually put your finger on something else here, which is this: how a lot of religions start, you know, which is that the people who were emotionally connected to that person, that charismatic individual, go, I can't believe he's gone. And so they have to generate a myth. I mean, you see it all the way through history. You see it with the King Arthur stories in England. You know, whoever King Arthur was or was not, apparently he's sleeping under a hill somewhere, waiting to come back and save Britain or save England from God knows what. You know, you see it right the way through history across all sorts of cultures, and it's a fascinating phenomenon in itself, that one. You know, I mean, that's a whole nother area to talk about. I mean, it's huge. Yeah.
Well, nothing stays dead, right? I mean, obviously, look at even Doyle's greatest creation. He killed him off, ceremoniously felt that he was done with it, and the pressure brought back Sherlock Holmes from the dead.
Well, thank you, because that is such a very, very good metaphor. That, you know, that whole idea that people were so emotionally connected and fascinated by Holmes, a fictional character, meant that he couldn't be allowed to die. And I think the same thing happens. The same process happens with people who are alive as well. It's fascinating stuff. I love it.
It is. I want to thank you so much, Matt, for getting up early over in England and spending some time with us this morning to shed some light on Conan Doyle.
Sure. No, it's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you very much for having me. Absolutely.
And if people want to find out more about you and your work, is there a website that they can visit?
Yeah, there's my publishing website, which is lifeisamazing.co.uk, which shows the books that I'm doing. And you've got Conan Doyle and the Mysterious World of Light is for sale there. You can also get that from Amazon. There's also my website, mattwingett.com. I have to tell you that my website is used for whatever rant I feel like at the time.
Great. Well, Matt, thank you. We'll point people to that and put the links up on the website. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Special thanks to Michael Weston, who plays Houdini in the series Houdini and Doyle, season finale this Monday, July 4th, on Fox. Remember to go check out all the past episodes on Fox On Demand. Again, thank you to David Jayer, our first hour guest, the Witch of Lime Street, Matt Wingett, Conan Doyle, and the Mysterious World of Light. And I want to especially thank Nathan Staten and Donna Walker back at the home office, Tim Dennis, my producer and co-host and engineer here in Minneapolis, Chris Boros, my producer, Lisa Lyon, and of course, George Norrie. Thank you for listening. Spend time with me Monday through Friday, 9 to midnight Central Time at darknessradio.com, and then always stay tuned for the best in overnight talk radio with George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM.